Hi, Becca. Thank you so much for appearing on today's episode of the Enabled in Academia podcast.
Hi.
Okay, so normally before I start, I always ask my guests what their best or greatest academic accomplishment is and tell us a bit more about themselves, so if you don't mind.
So I think probably at the moment my greatest academic accomplishment is sticking with my PhD, which I'm hoping to submit next year. I'm before my 50th birthday, if I'm lucky. I dropped out of a PhD when I was 26 because I had a baby, and coming back later in life in a completely different subject is a very nice way of kind of closing that one off. But I think that's my greatest achievement so far.
Okay, great. My next question is, can you tell us more about your project, TWIP, the Work Inclusion Project? I know that it was founded in January 2021, if I'm correct.
Yes, that's right. So my PhD research is in the jurisprudence of reasonable adjustments in employment. And I was working through a non-profit organization I'd set up called Just Reasonable Limited to do my PhD work. And also we have been representing disabled people in the Employment Tribunal. That was the vehicle that was funding my PhD and supporting the work that we were doing. While I was doing my PhD, though, I obviously encountered an awful lot of academics, and we ended up providing a kind of free e-clinic for disabled academics to get employment law advice, and we were representing more and more academics, disabled academics, and women who were having babies and so on in their discrimination claims against universities. And litigation is hard. I mean, litigation is just really depressing. Employment litigation is particularly brutal and harsh. We weren't actually delivering as much positive support to disabled people as I wanted to when I set up. And one of the problems I had always had myself was access to work. I'm autistic, I have ADHD, and I have kind of multiple physical disabilities, and so have always been eligible for access to work support for my disability at work. But I have really poor executive functioning and almost no admin skills. And so I couldn't get the paperwork together to get the funding to help get somebody in to help me with the paperwork and executive functioning problems. And eventually my best friend's wife helped me and managed to get all the paperwork in the right place at the right time. And I found my support work funded through Access to Work to be truly radical and revolutionary in my own mental health and the way that I was working. And so I was trying to share this information with the academics that we were working with in the litigation and giving advice in the e-clinic. But lots of people were finding the same problems, that the processing of access to work claims and explaining disability and academia and all of that to access to work was just very difficult and often too difficult given disabilities. So we set up the Work Inclusion Project, again, rather fortuitously, because my best friend, whose background from school, whose background is in recruitment and training, he also has ADHD, and he suddenly was available. So we launched January 21, a child of lockdown, frankly. And the Work Inclusion Project supports disabled academic professionals and entrepreneurs to get the funding that they're entitled to from Access to Work. And then we provide support workers, expert coaching, training and advocacy support services through Access to Work for disabled academics. We started, we're almost 3 years old, but not quite. And we have a remote team from sort of Scotland, actually further south now, as we have a member of staff in France. We have nearly 40 staff, and we support nearly 100 academics across the country with a variety of different specialist in-work support. And that is much more positive than litigation. And it gives us a really interesting insight into the day-to-day functioning of over 50 universities that we have really close working relationships with now. And it's much more, I find, a much more positive approach to be able to work with some funding from the Department of Work and Pensions and expert staff to actually support employers and disabled academics being able to make the workplaces accessible and productive. And our clients are able to, frankly, just do their jobs and not get ill and be able to compete in a really aggressive job marketplace on a level footing with non-disabled academics. And it's been really transformational for an awful lot of our clients who have been struggling often for many, many years. And lockdown particularly, I think, made an awful lot of people who had were barely hanging on really very stressed and unwell. And so we've been able to put this support in place, frankly, at a time when it's been most needed. And that's the Work Inclusion Project. And it's thriving and growing a little faster than we had anticipated.
But it sounds absolutely amazing. And do you mind telling us about how this Work Inclusion Project can be accessed?
So you can email steve@theworkinclusionproject.co.uk and he will be enthusiastic and unmedicated ADHD all over you and explain all of the things that are available and guide and help you through the process. And so we have a kind of a team of admin support staff who make sure we get all the paperwork in the right place at the right time. Yeah. And Steve will be able to guide you with his expert from now nearly 3 years of arguing with Access to Work on behalf of academics.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And just about Access to Work, like I've tried to speak to them as well. And I know that the administrative processes can be so difficult. Obviously, we're thankful that this opportunity exists, but I know it can take like several weeks even for sort of the funding to be in place, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So if you apply to Access to Work before you start a new job, then everything is much, much quicker and they will work really quickly to get stuff in place. Mm-hmm. If you apply after you started a new job or when you're already in post, it can take about 3 months before things start to, you know, the waiting list is very long. The Department for Work and Pensions operate in their own unique way in a staffing role. And we certainly found over, for example, during lockdown, when many more people were needed on universal credit helplines, they just took Access to Work staff away and there weren't people available to answer the phones. So it can take a few months. It's always a good idea to keep your employer informed because, frankly, if you've got 3 months wait before everything's going to be in place, then it can be useful to take the pressure off if everybody knows that things are coming, but that it's going to take a little time. But Access to Work is a government-run scheme. Anybody who is not a civil servant is able to apply if they are disabled. And the definition of disability is having an impairment that has a more than minor or trivial impact on you that is long-term. So either has already lasted 12 months or is likely to last 12 months. And that's it for the definition of disability. You don't have to have necessarily any specific diagnosis. It can be extremely useful if you know the kinds of things that you're asking for, because the Access to Work case handlers aren't necessarily the experts. You can get ask for a holistic assessment and then you'll be assessed by somebody who has a similar level of expertise that the Disabled Students Allowance assesses, and they'll write a report very similar to Disabled Students Allowance assessment report and suggest a bunch of coaching, equipment, training, whatever is required for a particular individual. And then they'll provide recommended prices, and then Access to Work will award a grant to effectively be allowed enable you to pay for whatever is being recommended. For large employers like universities, if you're not a new member of staff, the university will have to pay the first £1,000 of any overall need that you have, and then 20% above that. But again, if you're starting a new job, it's really, really useful to get onto Access to Work as quickly as possible, because Access to Work will pay 100% of whatever it is they recommend if you apply either before you start your job or within 6 weeks of starting a new job. So you can get the maximum amount of support, frankly, with the minimum friction from an employer, because they don't need to contribute any money and they can claim all of it back. Is to apply, you know, as soon as you start a new job or just before you start a new job, because then Access to Work will pay 100%. civil servants, if you're not a kind of university employer, but if you're a public servant researcher, then there's an internal process, an internal scheme that's not the access to work one. But yeah, it's online and very easy to find, but not necessarily easy to navigate afterwards. But it's important to know that when they email and say, you need to call us back within 24 hours or whatever very short time scale, they mean it and you really should. And so people who have ADHD or executive dysfunction issues should maybe get a friend to help them with this one, because missing those calls and having my claim cancelled is what took me 4 years to get any support from Access to Work, because I didn't have the admin skill to get back to them quickly enough to get the money to get somebody in to cover the admin skill.
Gosh, okay. So thank you so much for sharing that with us as well, and for opening up about some of your own sort of perseverances and your own journey. Okay, so do you mind me asking the next question?
Of course.
Okay, so I wanted to talk about some of your research project, some of your research and academic works, in particular from 2019 to 2021. Okay, so one of the articles that I'm interested in discussing is, it's titled Disability in the Gig Economy, Reasonable Adjustments for Engaging Workers or Anticipatory Adjustments in Providing Services, Society of Legal Scholars Conference. Do you mind telling us sort of what the findings were in that work and sort of the main take-home points?
So the main take-home point at the time that I presented that paper, when I just started my PhD, was kind of the height of the gig economy cases that were going through the Employment Tribunal and all the way up to the Supreme Court, the Uber-type cases, where the gig platforms were claiming that workers were fully self-employed, they were completely independent, they weren't entitled to holiday pay or minimum wage or any of these kinds of things. And so that they were, you know, basically just providing a service to self-employed people to find their own work. Obviously, the Uber claim failed at the Supreme Court, and Uber drivers were held to be workers. But the argument has been echoed in many jurisdictions across the world, with lots of different companies still making this argument that their services for self-employed people rather than platforms for work, which provide a different level of employment rights. And in the UK, we have two different types of workers' rights, a kind of basic worker and an employee. And the employee has enhanced rights. But so we're just talking about the sort of minimum 0 hours type, lowest possible level of employment right that an employer, that these platform and gig employers are aiming for. Now, there's an interesting anomaly, I think is the polite word to describe it, in the Equality Act in relation to reasonable adjustment. The duty on employers for making reasonable adjustments applies to very specific individual disabled people. So if Mary at work needs something to remove a disadvantage because of the way that her disability and the work systems interact, the employer has a duty to do whatever is reasonable for Mary at that time and nobody else. Education providers and service providers are required to anticipate the kinds of adjustments that disabled people are likely to need. So they don't have to have Mary in front of them. They're supposed to think, how are we going to make our university courses accessible to disabled people? How are we going to make the services that we provide accessible to disabled people? And so the anticipatory duty that's on service providers is a much greater duty, bigger one than the one on employers. And obviously, if you have a duty to anticipate the kinds of reasonable adjustments that disabled people in general might need, when you also come up and say, and I've got this additional need, which, you know, maybe isn't covered when you're trying just to make things generally accessible, then the distance between what Mary might individually need and what should already be there is much smaller when the duty holder is required to already have thought about disabled people. And so the main argument of that paper was to say, okay, well, in terms of disabled people working, and we know that the gig economy has disproportionate representation of disabled people within all sorts of precarious and gig and lower paid work. Disabled people are far more likely to be in that position, but also insecure and precarious work or lower paid work creates disabled people. It's a form of disablement when people are in high stress, low paid jobs. So if these platforms are trying to say that they don't have the duties that employers have towards disabled people or everybody in general, then my argument was that, well, that means that they are supposed to be anticipating the kinds of adjustments they should be making for disabled people, which actually is a much higher duty on them, particularly for disabled self-employed people. And so although the paper at the time was before all of the main most senior appeal judgments had been returned, but it was basically saying that actually, even if gig platforms end up being service providers and not employment providers, then actually there are ways in which disabled people can use the law to their advantage, because there are these additional duties for disabled people, towards disabled people, that service providers are required to undertake.
Yeah. And what sort of duties do you think that would entail?
So in terms of things like Uber drivers, it would be about making the app accessible to people who maybe had hearing impairments, or for people who were dyslexic, or for making sure that the standards and the particularly the punitive standards of when you got locked out or when you were no longer allowed to use the service provider's platform, that they were suitably accounting for people who had mental health problems, who might not be able to immediately take every kind of order that comes through, and so on, so that there would be an enhanced duty to make it easier for disabled people to make a living through those platforms, above and beyond the individual duty that an employer would have to remove disadvantage only for one particular person. And when we're talking about apps and platform apps, digital services, it's quite significant whether or not you have to think about disabled people when you're building the app, or only about an individual disabled person who might use the app later. And one of the biggest challenges that we see, particularly with large employers, and government employers, in the case law in employment disability discrimination, is where large IT programs and change programs come into place, and then we suddenly find that the disabled person who needs a particular bit of assistive software, that software isn't compatible with the new system. Mm-hmm. And so they can end up losing their job. Now, it makes a huge difference whether the digital service is required to have thought about disabled people at the outset of its development, as they would be for a service provider, or rather only in the delivery of it, as they would be for an employer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know also you have other work, such as your 2020 work, academic work, which also touches upon reasonable adjustments, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. All of my research work is based around the reasonable adjustments duty.
Mm-hmm. And do you mind me asking as well, sort of how, during your own PhD acquisition journey, etc., sort of any strengths and or weaknesses you incurred in regard to like disability support?
So in my first year of my PhD, disabled students allowance systems and my inability to do admin clashed quite badly, and I got rescued by the wonderful Harriet Cannon of University of Leeds Disability Services, who was able at the very end of my first year to put an awful lot of support in place. But the most, I think probably the most transformative experience I've had in relation to my disability is the support that I have had from my PhD supervisors. So my primary PhD supervisor is Dr. Liz Oliver, and she has been, well, she's been really radically supportive in the fact that she has developed ways of providing me feedback that my neurodivergence won't resist, and she has been from the very outset, modelling the type of thinking and behaviour that when I started my PhD journey was my idealistic dream of this is what disability inclusion should be like, but I'd never actually experienced it. And for me, one of the most radical learning experiences of my PhD has been learning to live and work and thrive within a properly adjusted environment. And that experience is what has been able to inform creating the Work Inclusion Project, where now, you know, we employ 40 people who we have duties towards. More than half of our staff are disabled themselves. And we work very much on that kind of basis of trying to create the sort of environment where we don't need to make reasonable adjustments for individuals, and you know, that it, our working environment is inherently flexible enough and supportive enough, whether your particular need today for doing something differently is because you're disabled or you're a carer or you're just having a bad day or you've got period pains or genuinely just the whole pile of human stuff that life throws at us. And having that experience from Liz from the outset, modelling what in my head was only an ideal, but she was able to turn into really amazing pragmatic support, has run through really the general approach to all of my research, and so that for me is the most significant and outstanding experience of my PhD has been for the first time in my late 40s finally being able to think, oh, this is what a fully adjusted accessible environment is for me, and that has allowed me to thrive in ways that reach way beyond my PhD.
That's lovely to hear. And before we go now, do you mind me asking if you have any top tips for sort of navigating the realm of disability in the legal field, and any other further reading recommendations you might have for the audience?
I do. So there's two key things that are really important to know if you want to assert your rights as a disabled person. Mm-hmm. You basically nobody has any duty to make a reasonable adjustment for you as an individual, and certainly not at work, unless they know or they ought to know that you're a disabled person. So however uncomfortable or difficult or embarrassing it might be or it might feel, it is really important to tell your employer that you are a disabled person, or to tell them what your impairment or your health conditions are, so that they have that information. And that if you're finding things challenging or difficult because of your disability, flag those up and make your employer explicitly aware of it. Keep those records of you telling your employer that you have these conditions or impairments and that you are finding these things difficult, because those two things are the most common way that employment tribunal claims are defeated against disabled people, by an employer saying, we didn't know whether this person was disabled, or we didn't know that they were likely to be disadvantaged, and so the duty to make an adjustment never arises. So knowledge is key in disability rights, and making sure that people are aware that you have the conditions that or impairments that are creating the disadvantages and the barriers when you try and interact with your employer or a service provider or your education provider. Just tell them. And if you tell them, then they have duties that are much more easy to enforce.
Yeah, absolutely. And as for further reading recommendations also?
I cannot recommend Sarah Ahmed's On Complaint more strongly. Her thesis of when you raise a problem, you become a problem, is something that disabled people often have to experience alone. Disability rights are not very often fought for collectively, in the same way that sometimes maybe other protected characteristics are for more collectively with, you know, LGBT communities or on gender and race panels, people have a greater sense of solidarity. So I think reading On Complaint and recognizing that your experience of being treated poorly if you raise a complaint. You're not alone. It's very common. And Sarah Ahmed's words and analysis can be validating in the extreme.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time and for appearing on today's episode of the Enabled in Academia podcast. Bye now.
Thanks.
Take care.
Cheers.